Welcome back to Dear Skylar, where I talk to all kinds of amazing people about topics I'm asked about as a transgender educator and activist. Things like sexuality and gender, race and sports, mental health, and so many things in between and beyond. Last week, I spoke with Olympian Lauren Gibbs, and you should definitely check out that episode if you didn't listen to it already. We talked about women's sports, including the inclusion of trans women and our bodies, especially loving our own bodies. We talked about how so much can impact perceptions of gender, particularly race, but also many other factors. And this week, I want to dive deeper into this topic. When I was a kid, I realized very early on that gender was like a game I was supposed to learn how to play. And often I wasn't playing it correctly. I learned that if I carried myself this way or wore those clothes or hung out with those people, that I would be gendered one way or another, depending on how I acted. And when I transitioned, this only became more clear to me, the gender roles so rigid. So today, we'll be addressing the following question. How can we liberate ourselves from gender as hazing? Hazing, you might wonder? Yes, hazing. I promise you'll learn more about what I mean and where this comes from this conversation with the wonderful and insightful KB Brookins. Take a listen. KB, I'm really excited that you are here today. We haven't met before this podcast, so I'm just like excited to meet you. We've been chatting and you've been talking a little bit about your hometown here in Austin, which is where we are. We're in an Airbnb that I've rented so we could record this episode. So if there's like background noises, I know there's birds chirping. It's kind of nice, the birds chirping. Yeah, very peaceful. So. Yeah. I'm really excited to meet you. I've read a lot about you. I've read a bunch of your poetry and honestly was like feeling teary when I was reading through a bunch of it. So I really appreciate your work. I'm just kind of curious if you could, for the listeners who haven't read a ton about you, perhaps, if you could give us a little background about who you are, name and pronouns, and go from there.
Right. I'm KB. KB Brookins is my, I guess, poet name.
Stage name.
Yeah, stage name. Let's go with that. Pronouns are they, them. I'm a Black queer and trans artist / cultural worker / writer, mostly of poems and essays. And I'm a career Texan. I've only ever lived in Texas. I've lived in Austin, Texas in particular for about 5 years. Outside of work stuff, I don't know. I am a foodie. I love like eating different food. I love being outside as much as possible. And I don't know, like, building and participating in community spaces,
Did you say you're a career Texan? Is that what you said?
Yeah. So like, I don't know. It's a term I endearingly say for people who have only ever lived in Texas.
Ah, okay. Gotcha. Yeah. No, I like it. I just haven't heard that before.
Yeah.
I guess I would be like a career Northeasterner.
Yeah. Yeah. There are career Southerners, you know, or people who have only ever lived in one country. It's just like,
yeah.
I think a backdrop to all of the things that I do, it's hard for me not to talk about place.
Yeah. Well, and I think especially, and you and I chatted briefly about this before we started, but, place being Texas, right? In this time of politics, I think is so salient. I want to talk to you about that, but I have a couple of questions sort of to start with. We're just going to like jump right into it because I'm not a fan of small talk. So
let's do it.
you wrote in Good Grief. I said this line earlier, but you wrote America is the worst group project. And that, you know, that poem had so many beautiful lines, but that one really stuck out to me. You also wrote, I'm Black, but maybe I'm doomed. And I thought those two lines really like went together. So I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that poem and what it means to you, and especially those two lines. I'm Black, but maybe I'm doomed, and America is the worst group project.
Yeah. So that's a poem that I feel like is now being considered like my most read poem because it's with the Academy of American Poets. And they're a pretty like well-known kind of like entity online. But yeah, it was a poem literally that started with me just like journaling my feelings. For all that don't know, Texas in 2021 had a really bad winter storm.
Right.
Colloquially and in the news called Winter Storm Uri. Lots of people, including myself and some of my loved ones here in Austin, were without power and water for something like up to 5 to 7 days. So it was a really precarious time because also like we were really underprepared as a state as well as like as people.
Right. The infrastructure. I read a lot about the infrastructure being really crappy and people's pipes freezing and, you know, water being lost. And anyways, continue.
Right. And Texas, like, kind of prides itself on being, like, this hot state, right? So, like, because of that, they think it's okay to, like, underprepare for intense weather conditions. But it's like, okay, if you continue to do a capitalism and, like, create all of these, like, bad weather conditions, of course, we're going to get the inverse of that, which is, like, bad winter weather, right?
Sure.
So it happened, and a lot of us were just, like, kind of stranded, like, unable to drive on the roads. When Northerners were kind of, like, making all of those jokes, like, it's just snow. And I'm like, okay, but y'all salt the roads. And y'all, like, have, tires set up to where, like, you can drive in these conditions. You have insulation in your homes. Like, we don't have those things.
Right.
So it was, like, really hard to drive, really hard to even, like, speak to people because it's like, okay, my power is out. I have to go into my car, but I can't just, like, stay in my car to charge my things, like, et cetera, right? So just fondling through all of those feelings. And also, like, the very next week, it was just like sunny outside. You see, like, no kind of trace of, like, what literally was just there a week ago.
Right.
So it's kind of like a whiplash of, like, oh, now I'm just back at, like, work and school as if nothing happened.
Almost like gaslighting.
Right. It's just like on a weather sense, I'm like, it's not the weather's fault, but it's very much like just so capitalistic to like not have any kind of period of mourning, period of grieving, or period of like even just processing what has happened.
Right.
Because we are not a people, because things are so built up now where we can like exist in those extreme conditions. Right. So it's just like a hard physical time as well as mental time. So I don't know. Sometimes my poems start literally as just journal entries.
Yeah.
So it's just like processing. And then I read this poem actually probably a couple months prior by Ocean Vuong, who's this really amazing queer Asian poet.
I think I actually might have read some of their stuff before.
Yeah. Ocean's awesome. And Ocean has this poem in the Poetry Foundation called Not Even This. And I just love the way that it's presented on the page, like as if it's like line by line, it's just like a sentence. And you have to like sit with that sentence and then go to the next sentence, etc. So I started thinking like maybe some parts of this journal entry can be a poem. And then I started putting it in that form and it felt like very important to put it like that because I was like, there's no other way to say the things that I'm trying to say. And I want to like make these kind of declarations that go like piece by piece. So then I wrote them like that, right? Like some of them are like me looking out at something. Others are like internal processing and others are like me kind of calling out these systems that have made stuff like this possible.
Sorry to interrupt you, but there's another line I wanted to make sure, since maybe not listeners have read it, they should. But there was another line where you said something, I might be paraphrasing, but it was like, my therapist tells me to rest as if capitalism was listening.
Right.
I think that's such a beautiful way to call out that system too.
Exactly. Like, it's like at every job now, they like try to put in the onboarding process, this like work-life balance thing. But I'm like, you don't actually promote that. You don't actually believe that to be true. Because if you believe that to be true, you would give me time off. You would give me paid time off specifically. You would give me healthcare, et cetera. So it's like very empty, I think, when someone is like, take it easy after this hard thing. I'm like, well, I still got to go to school. I got to go to work. That's not going to change, right? Unless other forces decide for it to change. But with America is the Worst Group Project, I think I saw something similar on Twitter and then was like, actually, this entire country is just like us continuously trying to work together, but not being able to because we don't agree on like a couple of simple facts,
right?
Which is like, humans matter more than money. Money is just green paper, right? And we valued money so much that some people are so greedy for it that they will shit on other people, right? And another thing to know about the winter storm was there were some of us who had a worse time than others. And that's always kind of been the case because of environmental racism, right? Racism is so, like, it permeates through all of the ways that we interact with literally the environment. So like how we interact with each other, how we interact with systems like schools, like jobs, et cetera. It was some people on the east side of Austin who had their power out much, much longer than others, right? Low income folks, right? Like things like that, that I was just noticing. And it's like, we're forced to be this group because we all have this same identity of being an American. But what does that mean really when some people are not putting in or not valuing the fact. It's just literally a simple fact that humans matter more than money, because they're intentionally trying to either devalue that fact or like act as if it's not the case. Right. So lots of choices were made that led us up to Winter Storm Uri. So that's what I'm kind of trying to speak to in that line, to say like, we're a group, but are we really? Right. As if like, you know, you have a school project and there's that one person who doesn't do shit, but still wants the A at the end of it.
Right.
And then the other line that you point to, it's just, I'm always in this, the Black American experience is one where you're always in conversation with history, right? Like, for instance, there is this thing called 23andMe, as you probably know, right?
I've taken it.
Like, you could
have my money.
Exactly.
And my data.
They put, they ask you for this spit, and then they like try to tell you all of these things. But actually, my bloodline only goes so far, right? Because my people came from slavery. And slavery was an like intentional kind of erasing of one's history before America. So my family has only ever known America. We don't know what happens before that. And that's like really intentional on enslavers and on colonization's part. So I'm always thinking about Blackness and all of the amazing things that it like recalls, but also the other things of like, there are just some things in life that I really hate that I can't change or I can't know, right? I often think about how before, I think about this thing that we like to call choice, right? Like, people choose what profession they go into. They choose what kind of life that they live. But I'm like, no, some people before I was born made an intentional choice for me to not know like more than three generations back of like my people. And for me not to know, we're seeing this especially now, like certain history, because they think that history is somehow uncomfortable to whiteness, right?
Well, subverts or like the power of whiteness.
Exactly. So it's like other people are making choices for me all the time and have made choices for me all the time. And, you know, I've been able to, and we always think about and talk about like Black excellence, and really that excellence is so much coded in like, you overcame all of these like choices that other people made for
forced
you.
Resiliency, if you
exactly will. Exactly. And I really hate the idea of resiliency too, because it tries to make normal things that are really abnormal, like the ways that people, lots of people set up adversity for you and they expect you to be like resilient despite that adversity. And I'm like, well, what if instead of focusing on Black folks and queer and trans folks being more resilient, we instead broke down the barriers that create those hardships for those folks. Right.
No, I think that's so important. And I think it's kind of goes with what, you know, of course I'm not Black, but I have experiences that I think are pseudo similar as a marginalized trans person, right? Again, pseudo similar, not the same. And I think about the kind of concept of people saying like, oh, you're trans, you're so brave, right? That like immediate response,
right?
And how, like I said, forced resiliency, and how I think a lot of people, and maybe yourself included, don't experience the you're so courageous or you're so brave with regards to our transness and perhaps with regards to your Blackness as a compliment, right? What it really says is, yay, good job for surviving the system of oppression that I'm complicit in.
Exactly.
Especially when it comes from cis people, especially when it comes from white people. Your thoughts are so like sort of beautifully crafted. I really appreciate you sharing those things. I'm curious how it does, how those experiences do connect, intersect, overlap with your queerness, with your Blackness. I don't know if you use queer. You said queer. I'm curious how those experiences overlap with the queer, with your queer and transness, if they do and if they don't.
Yeah. It's hard for me to ever think of myself as Black or queer or trans, like separately.
Sure.
All of those things happen at the same time.
Of course.
And even when someone is interacting with me as a queer person, being, you know, homophobic towards me or something like that homophobia is also colored and filtered through also Blackness, right?
Or anti-Blackness.
Exactly. And like, I'm thinking about, you know, all of the statistics we see online about, you know, trans women of color being like you know, brutalized by all of these people who are ignorant or, you know, at best fearful,
right?
Of themselves and of them, right? And it's a reason why Black trans women are the highest, right? As far as like who is aggressed. And it's a reason why I think when we think of the LGBT identity or like acronym,
right?
One of the kind of things that that's characterized by is whiteness, right? Like, and that's the case in queer theory. That's the case in LGBT studies. That's the case in like who women is gender studies. Exactly. And like who is in power in the largest kind of like LGBT organizations at a national level.
Right.
It's like, oh, okay, maybe in the past like 5 years, people have stuck like a Black queer woman or a Black gay man or something at the forefront of those organizations. But I'm like, who's on the board? Right. Mm-hmm. Like who really still has the power?
Right.
And who has the money? Who are the moneyed people that their programming is pandering to? But that's like a whole nother conversation, I think. But like, I think definitely I can't talk about transness would also like not talking about Blackness.
Sure.
I try to talk about, you know, in my work, how anti-Blackness is anti-transness. And when we like talk about those things at the same time, we're talking about first a group that overlaps, like Black trans people like simply exist. Sure. Right.
Yes.
And then also like there are so many things that overlap in those experiences and they're not the same, but they are very similar. Like for instance, I personally believe that like cis Black people have a lot more in common with trans people than they do, you know, white women, white men, right? Because it's like your access to gender is not the same as that of a white person. Mm. And there is a reason why, you know.
Wait, sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. Can you say more about that? That's like, I love that thought. Again, sorry for interrupting you. But that you said, you know, Black cis men have more in common with trans people than they do with white cis people. Can you say more? I can imagine, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. Like, why do you think that's the case?
Of course. I actually just read this book, We Real Cool, Black Men and Masculinity, by Bell Hooks. And she talks about how Black men, Black cisgender men, will not and have not historically had access to patriarchal masculinity in the same way that white men have.
Right.
Because simply put, systemic racism, right? Like a lot of factors are not on your side to where you can be this patriarch that you even want to be and that you so desperately like, you know, like, I don't know, aim to be in a lot of your thinking and a lot of your doing. But like
you might be like offered in concept of masculinity that you should quote be a patriarch, but then because of anti-Blackness systemically, there's no way, right, that the system's going to let you be, you know, the people who are running the country. So it's like a little bit of that duality. Is that what
exactly,
you're saying?
Right. And like, there's a reason why feminism, it's kind of like original whatever, didn't include Black women, right? Like you see them as less than women, right? And there's a reason why also like gynecology, like even as a profession, right, only happened because Black women were brutalized, right? Were given these kinds of experiments and things like that with no anesthesia, by the way, like really terrible stuff from who is still regarded the father of gynecology because simply put, he did not see those women as women, like as people who needed care in order to like go through these kinds of like experiments, right? So when I even like interact with things like, you know, transphobia from Black folks, because inevitably it happens, right? I'm just like, there is so much that we're missing. There are so many opportunities that we're missing by you not recognizing the fact that even the thing that you're currently defending is not all the way accessible to you either.
Right.
Like this idea of the gender binary and these like ideals that you hold so true to like what it means to you to be a woman, what it means to you to be a man, like you simply don't even have access to all of those privileges.
Right. Because it's framed in whiteness, right? It's like it's masculinity for white men, masculinity or femininity for white women. And you know, that's something that I think about a lot. I've done a lot of sort of research as well, especially with regards to sport and what does womanhood mean in sport. We don't have to dive into that, but you know, the inclusion of women in sports, right? Having women at all in sports was actually based on what kind of woman, white women. And so this like concept of sort of gender categories came out largely of in the research that I've done, and especially in learning from community, was largely a construction of white cis womanhood, white cis manhood, used to destroy indigenous cultures, both in Africa, or all across Africa, and also all across the Americas. So I think I just love the way that you describe that. I think what I hear also is an invitation to other Black folks, specifically right. cis Black folks, and maybe actually just all POC, right? To come into this conversation, especially if you're cisgender, and recognize that like the gender binary hurts you too.
Is that there's a reason why neo-Nazis are showing up to like anti-trans rallies. You know, there's a reason why like people who are transphobic tend to also be like racist. You know, like these things and these kinds of ideals all have something in common. I mean, of course it's hatefulness, but also it's like this idea of like me versus you.
Right.
Like, and this idea of like, I want the most power in the room. And therefore like these other people having the same powers as me really complicates disrupts. Or like devalues my identity, right? As a woman or as a man, there's a real struggle happening amongst cisgender women being like, oh, if like my organs don't make me a woman, then what is being a woman? And they're really, really unable to reckon with the fact that they want power, right? And like, if trans women have the same power as cis women, like, what does it mean, right? And like a lot of TERF ideology, I feel like I just see a lot of fear, a lot of assumptions, obviously, and inaccurate assumptions at that, but just a lot of like power struggle.
Right.
And I think that I always talk about anti-Blackness and anti-transness at the same time, because a lot of this like anti-whatever sentiment is really rooted in like, I want power, and you really need to be thinking about why it is that you want said power. And it's usually money driven, right? And it's usually like ego driven. But I think, you know, Audre Lorde once said, we don't live single issue lives, and we have to stop seeing everything like, the problem with queer folks, the problem with trans folks, the problem with Black folks, and et cetera, like as separate issues.
Right.
Because a lot of these things, I think trans people right now are like asking for the same things that like folks who are like anti-banning CRT, like.
Right.
These are the same fights, really similar fights, right? And we can recognize the uniqueness in each of us while also talking about like, we actually need to come together, and we are better together, and we are more of a threat to those people, right? Those people who are all bullies, right? When we stop thinking of our, you know, identities and our plights as separate things.
You know, the bills that they're proposing here in Texas, there's over 100 anti-queer, anti-trans bills here, not to even begin with all the anti-Black stuff that's going on here as well. You know, the hundreds around the country, and if you look at them, those bills are in tandem together with all the other, you know, it's not just anti-trans, like you said, not just anti-queer, it's anti-Black, it's also anti-indigenous, you know, there's, you know, a rise in anti-Asian hate, there's, it's just like all, you know, anti-feminism with banning abortion, and when people are like, oh, well, it's just about fairness when they're talking about trans athletes, or it's just about protecting children, then they won't ban, you know, assault rifles. It's just about, you know, like fair voting when they're, you know, just attacking Black voters. And if you look at any one of these issues, I think it's baffling to me that people can't zoom out a little bit. And especially when I say people, I mean allies or people who say they're allies. When you can't zoom out and see like, wait, hold on a second. This is like, this is a whole problem. This is America's, like you said, worst group project, where everybody is in their own little category, only doing the one little thing that's in front of them, and not recognizing that this is like a huge systemic issue that, like you said, stems from white supremacy. I think that as I'm thinking about this, I'm curious if there's like, this might be a, it might seem like a tangent, but it was bubbling in my head to ask you. So I've been asked a lot when I first recognized my own race. So I'm half Korean, half Asian, and half white. And so race has always been like so prevalent for me because my parents just look completely different. And I was always asked, you know, what race are you? And so that sort of intersection of race was just, I can't remember a time when I didn't know I was Asian, different from my transness, which I discovered later. And so I was just curious, as we're talking about race and as we're talking about your experience, you know, in all of these intersections, I'm curious if you have a time where you remember like recognizing that you're Black. And then the second question is like recognizing queerness, but I'm curious if we could start with the race.
So there's no like ambiguity when you look at me. I see race as a very like phenotypical experience, right? And like a socialized thing in the same way that gender is a socialized thing and not at all like inherently tied to biology. Like you're not predisposed to liking the color blue just because, right? Like you have certain chromosomes and genitalia, right? Mm-hmm. So in the like kind of socialization process of like being kind of knowing, I guess, my race, well, I grew up on the east side of Fort Worth, which a lot of people know is kind of the black side, the black and Latinx side of Fort Worth. So I only ever was around people that looked like me and like other folks like peppered in between, but mostly Latinx people, right? We're in Texas. So that makes sense. I don't know. I just never even really like interfaced or interacted with white folks unless we had to like for some reason interface with like systems of power, like governmental officials or something like that. And my parents didn't ever really need to do that, but I definitely felt a palpable distance between myself as a black person and my family as black people when, like, I don't know, we went to a different side of town.
Right, right.
I'm like, oh, they're looking at us for sure. And they, like, notice that we are, quote unquote, out of place, right? And there are some places in Texas as well as around the country where segregation really never stopped.
Right,
right. Like, there's a reason why in every given city, there's a distance, right, between the lower income part of town, which almost always is like the black and Latinx part of town, and then this like, or like POC part of town, and then there's like, you know, this richer side of town, which almost always equates to white, right? And even with like, when black people interface with that side of town, I remember going to college at Texas Christian University, at which at the time was like something like 80% white, right? So like in all of my classes, I was the only black person, you know? If it was black people at the college, it would either be black people who are moneyed, like come from money, black people on scholarship, like either it be athletic scholarship or academic scholarship. I was one of the academic scholarship folks. But like there was no instance where I was the majority, unless I was at like a black student union meeting or something like that.
So very strikingly different, it sounds like, from your growing up.
Right, right. So it was very much a culture shock when I went to college. And I remember, like, of course, I had like a understanding of blackness before then. But, you know, K-12 schooling, I don't think does the best job of like teaching you a lot about like the history of that label. And the history of what that's meant specifically in the U.S.
Especially not now where they're banning such teachings.
Exactly, because it makes some people uncomfortable. It's bullshit. But yeah, then I went to this very white university and was like, oh my God, me being black here is so filled to the brim with like stereotypes in other people's heads. So I just felt very conscious of my race in a way that I didn't need to previously. Unless, again, like those very one-off times that we maybe needed to go to a county office or something like that, right?
Right, right.
So yeah, then it just gave me this new relationship, this very like filled relationship with blackness. And also I was a college student during the time that Trump got elected, right? Which put on display where we are with race, like at the time in 2016. I remember feeling almost like I could dissociate myself out of the like really rich experience of racism before that point. But then I was like, oh, there are neighbors that have like Trump flags up, so I like know how they feel about me, you know? Or there are like people on, you know, these social media platforms who are saying things about me when they say things about black people, right? When they say things about people who are complaining, people who need to just fall in line, all of that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I have always known that I'm black, but I didn't really know the extent to how many stereotypes and how many aggressions people have towards black people probably until I went to college.
Right, right.
And with queerness and transness, that probably actually is the label, because I grew up mostly just around other black people that felt like really, really present. Like when I was young.
Learning that label, you meant felt really present.
Right. Like even before I knew what queer was, I knew it was not something that I should be. Right. Just based on my family is very religious. Like my mom played, you know, the piano in church type thing. My dad was a preacher. Like, we were just very much in the black church and in just, like, kind of that religious fundamentalism, because not every religious community is really like tied to some of these like antiquated ideas about right. queerness and transness, but like mine definitely was. So like when I, if I did hear something about someone being gay, it was always with a like negative tone.
Gotcha.
Right.
Yeah.
And like if I did see, I remember like I watched this interview recently actually with the singer Ciara, right? I love BT. I watch 106 in Park all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And she was talking about people saying that she was a lesbian, right? And then there was this actually like rumor at one point that she was intersex, like when she was like really coming up as an artist. And she said something in that interview, and I doubt that she still feels this way. But she was like, when addressing those rumors, there are always going to be people that want to bring you down. Mm-hmm. And everyone was like, yeah, they're trying to bring you down by like saying that you're intersex or saying that you're a lesbian. Right. Mm. So that was just very much the sentiment in my youth.
Right, right.
And before, when I like started to kind of express myself as an individual, people were just like, there's something different about you. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I remember going to middle school because that's very much the time where people all of a sudden care so much about these social hierarchies sure. and things like that.
Yep.
And I remember someone calling me a slur, right? Like, I don't know if I can say it on here, but the D word in particular, right? And I didn't know what that meant because I'm a seventh grader and I'm 12, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but I knew it was bad
right.
just based on how everybody around me reacted. I was just like, what is this about? It has to be about me being like too boyish, me being like too masculine. And like, I don't even think I was wearing things in the quote unquote men's section at the time. But like my demeanor has always not been that of like a super hyper feminine person. Right.
Sure.
And the way I just carried around my body just seemed like an issue to other people. Mm-hmm. Right. And yeah, so I think that with me kind of being, I would say like hazed, I think of gender as a hazing process, like almost when you're mm-hmm. young, because it's like, well, people gender you before you are even born, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. As soon as it's a girl comes, there are a load of stereotypes that happens after that, right? Or it's a boy, right? Either or. For everybody who doesn't fit neatly into those labels, it really does feel like a hazing process. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I was always kind of course correcting as a child. But even with that overcompensation for trying not to come off as queer, people were still seeing it. You know, they were still like, you don't fit in.
Right.
And
right.
this is why kind of thing.
Right.
So I feel like I was just fighting for my life in seventh grade and eighth grade and middle school in general, like trying not to be called gay. But people were just calling me gay. It just kind of was what it was. And probably by ninth grade, I was like, all right, so what am I going to do about this? Because I'm not fitting in. And I know this is why. I've also always been like a bigger person, right? So it was like stuff about that. But that was kind of like not as important to me as this like queerness thing. And I didn't have any community at the time. So it was just kind of like either I'm going to keep denying these allegations or actually I'm going to lean into it. Because by high school, it was maybe like 7 people or something, like out of my 400 plus people high school that were like out mm-hmm. as like lesbians. Mm-hmm. And people seem to be fine once you lean into it.
Gotcha.
So, I mean, you know, there are always those comments like here and there. Of course, when you get on somebody's bad side, all of a sudden, you know, they're just going to talk about that thing about you. Mm-hmm. But then I was like, okay, I'm going to lean into it and just be a lesbian because that's the only option here. Like either you're gay, you're a lesbian, or you're straight, you know? And I grew up in the early 2000s. So literally it was gay and lesbian studies. It wasn't even LGBT studies yet at the academic level. Yeah. Right. So yeah, then, you know, as I go on now, people are, you know, making, and it's funny because I feel like even in the seventh grade, all of those, you know, anti-queer slurs were also anti-trans slurs.
Right.
Because it was like, you're being too boyish. Mm-hmm. Like, you're acting like a boy, and therefore you're gay. The ways that we talk about people are just so weird and, like, always interstitching gender and sexuality in ways that they don't always necessarily, like, merge. But So it was like kind of anti-queer, anti-trans slurs. And I think also lesbian sentiments at the time felt very like anti-trans, like trying to differentiate themselves between trans people. But at that time, I had never even met a trans person yet. So it's like, I don't even really know where I stand on this issue because I don't know enough, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, before I was even like woke to the fact that I was Black and that meant something to other people, I feel like I was trying not to be queer. And then it's like, whatever, I'm going to just do it, but it's still not the label that actually fits because the labels were still way too restrictive. So it was a very like iterative process for me, like going to college, meeting more queer and trans people, luckily, but of course that queerness and transness is very riddled with whiteness. So it's like, I don't know, still not a place where I feel like people understand me in particular. And amongst, it was so bad to the point where like, if people needed to identify me, right? And at the time I went by a different name and it was multiple people with my same name, they would be like, oh, the gay one, when they were talking about me. Like, that's the times that we were in. Like, that is how, like, I was differentiated, right? That's how different it was for me to be queer at that time.
Right.
And I honestly credit me finally coming to the realization that I was trans with, like, moving to Austin.
Because you're saying sort of departing from home was a big deal.
Exactly. I had to get out of other people's eyesight. I think other people who had known me for so long and had ideas about who I should be in order to be myself. So I don't know. I moved to Austin on a whim of like, I just really can't stay here much longer because I went to university in my hometown as well. So it's like, oh, I left home, but it's like a 20-minute drive, right? So I'm still like very much connected to home stuff. And I needed an excuse to have some distance. And I was just like, I'm going to move here. And luckily when I moved here, I just was exposed way more to more possibilities as far as it like related to gender and sexual orientation. And then I was like, now that I know there are these options, like, I remember like learning first what like non-binary was, just like getting non-binary friends. And I was oh, that makes sense for me. And it's like, I had to actually just be exposed to other possibilities in order to get to the place where I feel like these labels still don't feel quite exact, but they feel as closer than they've ever been to how I would like to define myself. And it's wild. And I think this is something that Republicans and centrists are very scared of. People being exposed to different possibilities. Therefore, they will stop, you know, subscribing to gender and subscribing to these narrow ideas of sexual orientation.
Well, because what they really mean when they're afraid, you know, that anybody exposed to possibility will stop subscribing to gender is what they'll stop being oppressed.
Right.
They'll stop being repressed.
Exactly.
Which I think is, you know, a huge threat to the system of power.
Right.
One of the things you're talking about in terms of like, you said you found words that were better, right, but not perfect. Language is always an approximation.
Right.
I've heard there's another trans non-binary activist, and they say their name is L. Duran, and they say, I am not non-binary. Non-binary is a word I use to describe myself. And I think that's such like a fantastic way to describe it. But, you know, I was thinking about, you were talking about when you sort of, you've always known that you were Black, but you didn't necessarily understand the social implications, it sounds like. Like you knew what Blackness meant to you, but you hadn't yet discovered what Blackness meant to other people, specifically white people. But then it sounds like it was kind of the reverse for queerness. You knew what queerness meant to other people sooner than you knew what it meant to you.
Exactly.
Until you sort of were able to piece that apart. What is such an interesting juxtaposition there.
Right.
But I love that, you know, you're a writer and that you're sort of always sort of iterating with words, looking for the closest approximation, something that I feel is so powerful. I wrote down a sentence that you said. I wanted to repeat it back and ask you something about it. You said gender is a hazing process. And I don't disagree. As somebody who's been on a men's swim team, right, a college men's sports team, where, you know, I think men's sports in general, I won't speak specifically about my team, but just like generally speaking, you know, we hear a lot about hazing in men's sports, right? A lot of group activities in college in general, but especially men's sports. And a lot of it is gender based, right? Like, I think a lot of like, if you just think about like, not even gender as hazing, but if you think about hazing, the things that come to mind for me are all gendered,
right?
Like, you know, men's sports teams forcing people to, you know, I don't know, drink or to do like things that are considered masculine, right? Whether that, or like, I've even read about like women's sports teams and women's sororities where they do things like body shaming mm-hmm. stuff, which really align with like diet culture, but right. also very gendered.
Right.
It's so fascinating. If you think gender as hazing, you just like flip it.
Right.
I think that's so true. So in that vein, how have you, and the answer can be, you're not sure, because I would be not sure, but how have you sort of liberated yourself from gender as hazing and discovered not only what gender means to you, kind of in that journey of, you know, you knew what queerness meant to other people, but what about for you? So as you did that, how did you liberate yourself from gender as hazing?
Right. It started honestly with getting out of people's eyesight, like getting out of the eyesight of people who are like really committed to seeing me as what they wanted to see versus like what was actually in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a really important first step. And I felt like such guilt, right? Because we think of family as like this thing that you should just be allegiant towards no matter what, right? And I don't like hate my family by any means, but I was like, I need to get away so I can figure out who I am. Because so much, I mean, like, which is why college is such a like eye-opening experience for so many people. It's like, all of a sudden you are aware of the fact that you only think things because your parents think them, right? Or because your teachers thought them at your school that you spent most of your time at. So now you got to come up with your own thoughts or continue to let your life be washed in somebody else's ideas, right? So yeah, post-college and post me, like a failed attempt at going to grad school, I like came to Austin really because I was just soul searching. I was like, I don't actually know. I had also just got out of a relationship, such a like dramatic time, but like,
such as post-college life.
Exactly. Like, who am I? Like, what am I needing to do? Who am I as a person? Who am I as like a potential romantic partner? Who am I as a friend, even? If I'm doing this whole like I wouldn't call it abandonment, but like definitely like separation process from everything that I've known before this moment. And yeah. Now I very much feel like as it pertains to gender and sexual orientation, like I had to stop caring about what other people thought. Of course, I think that sometimes that is just a cop out to be like, don't care what other people think.
Yeah.
Because it's like, some of us have to care what other people think.
Yeah.
Like I had to care what other people thought in order to stay safe when I was growing up.
Absolutely.
So it's like carefree. Actually, there are other people who have made choices to where I can't be carefree. Right.
Yeah,
like other people who are not me. So coming to this, you know, liberal, very white liberal city and finding other people who would not like see me and see, you know, a child caricature of me or see like all of their own ideas, like I think just really opened up something for me. Like I have friends now that, you know, before they know someone, they like actually ask them about themselves.
And what like, a concept.
Exactly.
It's like, instead of assuming.
Okay, what is your name? What are your pronouns? Like, how do you like to exist in the world kind of thing? And it takes more than just pronouns in order to like actually see someone as whatever gender they like to see. But for me personally, I'm like, okay, if gender is like X and Y, I am probably like a number. I'm like not even a letter because I'm not really like interested in being gendered. And my friends get that. And of course, there are strangers now. And it's such an interesting vantage point, you know, like going through life being seen as a black girl who people definitely don't always treat the best, right? And then now people, the average stranger, perceiving me as a black man, which is also like an unsafe categorization.
Right.
So it's like from one violence to another in a way. And specifically seeing me like as a like black lesbian and now being seen potentially as a black, like people often like see me as like a black gay man often because I'm like, I'm not like even like doing the patriarchal masculine things that one expects you to do when you are a man. Right. Which is still wrong. So I'm like, I just have had to make peace with strangers not understanding. But I'm like, if you really want to put effort into understanding me, then I'll tell you. But like, I can't care. I can't go through my whole life caring about any given stranger. Of course, there are some strangers where I do have to care. Like when I'm in a men's locker room or something, I am very hyper aware of like how I present gender wise.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
When I'm in instances of like, can I be safe? Right. I think about it. But if I don't have to think about it, if I'm just at the Whole Foods or down at the HEB, right, which is what we have here, I just can't. I can't let all of those things get to me because then it just becomes chatter. And then it like informs the way I dress and all of these other things.
You begin to internalize it. Yeah. Right. I wanted to go back. One of the things you said, you're not interested in being gendered. And then at the same time, I think, especially from what I've read from testimony from my friends who are also Black and trans, being perceived as a Black lesbian woman and being perceived as a Black gay man or just a Black man in general, both of those are seen as a threat in society, right?
Exactly.
For many, many reasons, as we discussed. And I think one of the things that kind of going back to what you said about what kind of sort of gender is available, right, to what people, I think society, and I'd love for you to speak more on this, society sort of overwhelmingly masculinizes Black women and then over masculinizes Black men, but not so much that they could be a patriarch, right?
Yeah.
It's like masculinized this level, but not on the like power part. And so I was curious because I have the opposite experience as an Asian man. I am perceived as hyper weak, right? As effeminate, and that happens in both before transition and after. Like in my womanhood, I was perceived as sort of exotic and fetishized, and you know, the sort of perfect woman of you know, exotic Asianness. You know what I'm saying, right? Where it's like, where it's submissive, sort of like submissive womanhood, right? In Asian womanhood. And then now I'm perceived as an Asian man, which is also largely considered submissive, weak. And so I have this addition of transhood, which demasculinizes me in a lot of people's eyes. And then Asianhood, which also Asian manhood specifically, which demasculinizes me. So I'm invisible. Right. I'm not seen as a threat, but I'm usually seen as somebody who just kind of isn't there.
Right.
And I know that your experience is likely exactly the opposite of that, where not only is it threatening to womanhood to be Black, but also threatening to masculinity somehow to also be Black. And then as somebody for you who doesn't identify as either of those categories, how do you hold that? How do you, you said you can't care what people think. I think you're right. And sometimes you do need to care, but how do you depart? Like, are there tools that you use? I know this is like a really nitty gritty question, but I'm really curious how you're able to not care, or what ways you sort of, I don't know, walk into that journey.
I mean, community, right? Like surrounding myself with people that get it, you know? And when I'm in situations where people don't get it, like having that affirmation in my actual like personal life makes it so I can get through those situations.
Right.
Cause for sure, like, since I've had this, you know, patchy hair on my face and, you know, things like my voice has dropped, I've seen, you know, when I am upset, when I'm not anything that's like super chipper, how that is so threatening to other people, because of this kind of like Black masculinity and the ideas that people have about Black men as like not even people, like people who are not at all in tune with their emotions and et cetera, et cetera. So it makes me empathize a lot more with like Black cis men. But with that being said, right, I don't identify that way. So being around other people who get it most of the time, and then in those situations where people don't get it, like, I guess choosing my battles maybe is the right word. Because there's this really good article by Hunter Ashley is I think their name, which is like, you can never misgender me. So
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I actually just looked at, I was recommended to read it yesterday. Timely. Yeah.
And I very much agree. It's like, you can't, my gender is so personal, or my lack thereof of gender is so personal and such a shared like thing between me and others that it's like, oh, if you use he, him pronouns for me in this moment, you're not misgendering me. Maybe like you're misapproximating my pronouns, but like I that means nothing to me, really. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I understand people who for whom like it means a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think those people's like identities need to be respected. And their wishes need to be like, and they will be, right? Like, granted, if we get so out of this idea of like seeing someone and immediately putting them in a box,
right? Right.
But it's going to take a lot of like deprogramming on the kind of socialization,
unlearning that we need to do.
A lot of the socialization side of things. But I don't know. I see no other way of really like navigating, because I mean, like, I very much still get she heard by some of my family members. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in those moments, it definitely feels uncomfortable. Like, it's much more uncomfortable for me, admittedly, to get like she heard than it is to get like he him'd. With he him, I'm just like, oh, you looked at me and made a choice,
right? Right,
whatever.
Right,
when it's she her, it's like you are definitely locked into this idea of me,
right?
That literally, like, phenotypically and also literally legally no longer exists.
Sure.
So it's kind of like bringing me back to those childhood times when I hear that. Of like someone literally telling me that I'm not performing femininity well. So I'm like, I'm not even doing the she her thing well, but that's still how you see me, which is interesting.
Yeah. It goes back to people making choices for you before you have the chance to
exactly
say anything. Yeah.
Exactly. And we need to start seeing, and I think a lot of this like anti-trans youth kind of sentiment is like, we need to start seeing youth as people with agency and people with like own their own ideas and their own uniqueness about like who they are.
Yeah.
It's like This perpetual idea, you know, that it's like, oh, they're young and they could change their mind later, or oh, they don't understand X, Y, and Z. And it's like, no, like, I very much was hyper aware that something was up way before I was 18, mm-hmm. probably as early as like first grade at least. Mm-hmm. And that was when I started like even just having my own thoughts. As soon as I could have my own thoughts, I knew that whatever it is, like whatever this expectation of me is, it's going to be very hard for me to meet it, right? Mm-hmm. On a gender level. So, I mean, to get through this continued hazing that is gender, mm-hmm. that is kind of like given to me by legislators and strangers, I just have to really cover myself. And I believe every, you know, trans person and every person in general like deserves this to like, mm-hmm. have themselves like cloaked with people who get it.
Cloaked with people who get it.
Yeah. That's the only way that like people who don't get it won't like crush you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's spot on. It's kind of what I talk about with my clients who are young trans people, and what I tell myself too, because you know, the expectation that we're going to rid the world of white supremacy immediately, or transphobia, or misogyny, or the gender hazing, right? All of these are kind of the same thing, but we're, you know, many words for the same system of oppression.
Right.
Hopefully we will get rid of these systems at some point, but it's not going to happen tomorrow. And it's probably not even going to happen, you know, soon enough that we'll be able to live without it. Mm-hmm. But what we can do is create our own bubbles where we feel seen, where we feel, like you said, most of the time we are having people mirror back our humanity. Or asking it. I love what you said, where you like you have friends that will ask you not only name and pronouns, but how do you want to walk through the world? I think what a different world we would have if instead of people making assumptions about other people's gender or anything else based on how they look or how they, you know, show up in one single moment, what if we ask people, how do you show up in the world? Like, how do you like to interact? I think that's such a radical concept, and it's yet so simple.
Right. And I mean, like, it permeates through so many other things. Like, currently, right, Texas is in this legislative session where a lot of stuff is happening. Mm-hmm. A lot of aggressions are happening on a kind of anti-trans level. Mm-hmm. And continuously, I see, you know, in various comment sections of people who are day in and day out, you know, like fighting these systems, some northerner that's like, oh, the problem is y'all are doing X, Y, and Z. And the problem is y'all are peacefully protesting and not doing X, Y, and Z. And I'm just like, bro, your experience is not the experience. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like the reason why I write the books that I write and like center my experience as a Texan is like, so many people just don't understand how a different location's like political body can just like wash your entire experience of what is and isn't okay to do. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, okay, maybe you can put cars on fire and flip them in New York, but like even something as small as like a lawyer trying to sue, you know, a governmental body in Texas will probably get them sanctioned in a lot of places, right? Mm-hmm. Like probably get them to be like not able to go home to their families, not able to do X, Y, and Z. Because we know once people, and this is a reason why they wield this power so much at the legislative level, you know, once people have a criminal record, so many rights are taken away from them.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So admittedly, some of us are not willing to do that, especially sure. like you're telling like Black trans people that they should be doing more to put themselves in danger. Like, right, don't do
right,
that.
Right. Right.
It just feels so washed with like my identity. Yeah. And like yeah. my identity is the only identity. And like, my idea of what should be done on an organizing level is the only idea.
Right.
So, I don't know. I just wish people would like listen to the people who are in their own bodies. So understand what those bodies need and listen to the people who are on Texan soil. And like, we know what it is to be trans in Texas and like just take our lead. Right.
Yeah. I love that line you said. I wish people would listen to people in their own bodies. And I think Chase Strangio is the lead ACLU attorney for trans rights. And he and I were talking about the history of these laws and the history of the Constitution, which all goes back to a Constitution built, written, created to protect slavery, right?
Right, exactly.
And protect a country whose economy was solely built on slavery and therefore the backs of stolen African folks. And of course, you know all of this. I'm just sort of encapsulating the context of my question, which is, so he was talking about this is where it all comes from, and how that means that the Constitution of the United States are built off of robbing people of their bodies,
right?
Robbing people of their bodily autonomy. And so now we're here where we are doing that with anybody who can get pregnant, and we're doing that with any trans people. And we're consistently, of course, doing that with Black folks, Indigenous folks, other POC, especially Black and Indigenous. And so I'm thinking about what you just said, where what would it be like if we could actually give people back that autonomy simply by asking them? It's not even like, we're not even talking about rights at this point. We're talking about how we fight for the rights, right? How do we then, or can we say, what is it like for you to live in your body? And how can I just listen to that? I was reading about, an article you wrote about Kendrick Lamar and how it sounds like, and I'll be full disclosure, I don't listen to a lot of music. So I do not know Lamar's like music very well, but I was reading this article where you're talking about sort of his attempt to address queer phobia in the Black community specifically, and how he kind of tries and doesn't quite succeed.
Right.
And we can talk if you'd like, you can talk specifically about the article and about Kendrick Lamar, but I'm kind of more curious about imperfect allyship, quote unquote, more generally, and especially within the Black community. I hear a lot of empathy that you have for Black cis folks who might perpetrate transphobia, because what they're really doing is perpetrating white supremacy that's internalized.
Right.
But I'm curious kind of what you have to say to those folks, to your community, to Black folks, but then also to expansive communities, right? White cis folks as well, or just cis folks in general, on allyship that's imperfect and can improve.
Right. I think it's important to like remember that we're not expecting perfection. Like when we say, oh, I'm an ally to a community, because I'm like, I don't have every marginalization. So I consider myself like an ally to other communities. But when I say ally, it's a verb, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's a number of actions that you commit lifelong to doing in order to uplift, you know, maybe things you don't understand, maybe things that, you know, you need to read in order to understand. Cause I don't think like things like transness are like so hard that nobody can understand, right? That may mean that you need to admit to wrongdoing every now and then. And like, I would like to say, no matter how many Kendrick Lamar stands in my comments disagree, I think I was being, and I tend to be in general, very generous towards people who at least make the attempt.
I think I read it as generous. I didn't read it as attacking. Even the title says that, you know, have a long way to go. I didn't hear it saying this is horrible. It was saying like, okay, you started.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Exactly. You would have thought I said like, fuck him, fuck his mom, like, like fuck his family. Like, by the way that people like reacted to it. But I think like, it's a real issue with like, oh, you're bashing him because he didn't get it perfect, right? And I'm like, well, he is not queer. He is not trans. I don't expect him to like know really the ins and outs of what that experience is. But I do expect if you're going to put out media and stuff talking about, and like, I think it's really important for other allies to talk about how they got over their bigotry. Mm-hmm. And I know that was the goal, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But you don't need to like say slurs in order to do that. You don't need to do X, Y, and Z, right?
Yeah. Misgendering people.
Exactly.
Dead naming people, yeah.
And it's like, I understand, and there are ways in which you can continue to work on this. Because if you're an ally, if you are a person that is always in motion towards, like, you know, other people's liberation, then I think you should be able to hear when you do something that is not right, right? Like, when you get feedback from said community that you're trying to be an ally to, like, really sit with. And it's like uncomfortable for anybody to hear like, hey, you hurt me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a human response to be like, ouch, you know? but I think,
or darn.
Yeah. It's like, especially like when you didn't mean that, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of the times when we hurt each other, it's not like, oh, I woke up and decided to be a villain. It's like, you're a person and you're not in somebody else's head. So you don't know everything that's going to offend them. Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think what is different between an ally and a perpetrator, right, is someone who is willing to receive feedback and then be like, I'm gonna do better in the future and actually do better, right? So I think what allies really need to understand in this current time, in this current like fight that trans folks are in, that Black folks are in and have always been in, both of those communities, is like, educate yourself on the issues. When you try, like actually try and be okay with potentially doing it wrong and then just adjusting as you go. It's like, it's as if people think that we got all of this knowledge just like downloaded to our brains. Like there was a moment in which, and there are still moments in which I may like know someone's pronouns, but like mess them up.
Sure.
But I immediately change. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's how we get better.
Yeah.
That's how in the future I don't do that. Right. Mm-hmm. Because I like switch. And I think we as people, like in general, like we aren't born knowing all of this knowledge, and like not expecting that of people, I think is good. Like if you're going to interface with allies, because like genuinely some people don't have the patience, and I respect that. You don't have to like be continuously like educating people on your identity. I don't think that's like trans people's thing that they should be doing, and neither Black people. But for those who do have the patience to do that, we're not expecting allies to be perfect, mm-hmm. but we are expecting you to put in effort. We are expecting you to not support us in the shadows, right? Like actually say something out loud, because actually there are certain conversations that I'll never be able to enter because I'm Black, because I'm trans. Mm-hmm. Like some people are just going to feel more comfortable being racist, you know, in front of non-Black people. Or like now that I, to some people come off as a Black man, there are things that people say in front of me that they would not have said if they still saw me as a girl, right? And in that moment, it is my duty, if I say I'm an ally, if I say I'm a feminist, to say something.
Yeah.
And even if it's not like exactly, like I can reflect on it and be like, oh, I could have said that better, right? But like, I'm not just gonna not say anything, right? And I'm not just gonna not like, like when I have access to conversations that other people don't have access to, like not put myself, who knows, maybe potentially in harm's way in order to be an ally. Yeah. Right.
Well, and I think that, you know, that's a central part of allyship that I like really focus on when I am doing the education that I do. Shane Wally actually earlier said this to me. And Z said, allyship is taking the risk that I take every day for one moment, right?
Exactly.
And I think, you know, that concept, what does it look like? It looks like stepping in and actually in the places where we can't be for whatever reason, right? Having those conversations. And even like, you know, in conversations where I think I'll just be really frank with you. I think people sometimes bring me in as a DEI educator and they'll say trans and say, oh, great. And this guy's also a person of color, but he's not Black.
Right.
And I think that's comfortable for them, right? I think, or more comfortable for them because I'm more palatable. I'm closer, whatever closer means, to whiteness, in the sort of hierarchy that racialization has created. And I'm asked to speak on blackness sometimes in ways that I think are really inappropriate because I'm not black. And so I'll often say that and often try to, you know, pass, hey, you should go look at this person's work or that person's work. But people want to hear it from me, which I think is fascinating. And what I guess what I'm trying to highlight in terms of allyship is that in that moment, I have an opportunity to be in a conversation that they're not inviting black folks to. Right. And then similarly, with womanhood and misogyny, there are so many conversations now I'm suddenly privy to where I'm no longer the object, right? The victim of misogyny, but now I'm expected to perpetuate it, like you were just saying. And it's a very dysregulating experience on a personal level. But it is a moment where I get to then be an ally.
Yeah. And I mean, we're living in a time where people are so scared to offend.
Yeah.
Therefore, they're just like, I'm going to just be a bigot. Like, I'm going to just, you know, really lean into my bigotry because it can make me money because I can then be the victim in this situation. But like, really, I think it a lot of people who end up doing that, and we see it all the time with cis women lately, is like a real scaredness to offend. But I'm like, again, we don't expect perfection. Like, we just expect you to try. And when you try and mess up, you really need to be receptive to feedback.
Right.
And like, there is definitely like a scaredness to be actually be faced with those people who face said oppressions because you're scared to offend. Right. But I'm like, I actually, and I do, you know, LGBTQIA plus trainings and what I call idea trainings, because I'm always trying to bring access into the room as well. And I'm like, I'd much rather you ask me a question that you think you're like embarrassed to ask versus like you going out into the world and like believing those things.
Yep. I say the same thing, but you said people are so afraid to offend. And one of the things that made me think of is like, they're afraid to offend and I wish they'd be more afraid to hurt.
Right.
And the distinction there for me is if your sole goal is to not offend, you're going to keep a lot in your head and carry those beliefs outside and go hurt people. But if you're afraid to hurt, then you actually, if you think about it in the most utilitarian way, you might actually be willing to offer, here, this is the thing.
Right.
I don't want to keep hurting people, help. Right?
Right.
And if you're afraid to hurt, you might actually say when somebody says, hey, that hurt me, you might, oh, shoot. Okay, thanks.
Exactly.
Cool. Now I'm committed to not hurting. So now that I know that, I'll do better. Right. And it's a conversation I've had with a lot of wannabe allies, I'll say, where they're so committed to the title of ally. Mm-hmm. And we can put that in anything, right? I'm not anti-racist. I'm not transphobic. But the commitment to that title has to come with action.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually, more importantly, has to come with being able to apologize and move on.
Right.
And I think that's what you're hitting on, is that it's so important for people to understand that they can't know everything. And I think part of actually anti-trans rhetoric and anti-woke, whatever that means, culture has actually painted, quote, wokeness as this thing you can't possibly make a mistake. And it's almost created cancel culture, if that makes sense, as an entity that I don't actually know if it exists. I don't know people who actually truly cancel people. I know a whole lot more people that have a whole lot more grace, like you, who say, actually, you're going to mess up. Of course you're going to make a mistake. Mm. It's what you do when you make a mistake, not the fact that you made it in the first place.
Right. And I'm like, well, wokeness is also just like racist, right?
Yes,
but like, I think people take, because I won't say that there are not people who will just like cancel you over anything.
Sure, that was a generalization.
but that is not the majority of people, like by far.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you're taking one minority kind of like sentiment or minority kind of action and applying it to everybody who asks you to just not be a dickhead to people who are not like cis white men,
right,
I guess.
Right.
But it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's made up oppression.
Well, even the people who do, like, let's say there are people, some small percentage of people who do cancel people. They're also doing that because it's pain that they're experiencing.
Right.
I think that's also what people miss. And what allies miss, or wannabe allies in this case, budding allies, training allies, is that when somebody does cancel somebody, right, quote, cancel, it's not about canceling that person. It's saying, I'm no longer opening myself to this pain, right? I am no longer going to let this be a place that you can access me.
Right.
And that doesn't mean you have to stop being an ally. It doesn't mean you have to stop trying to improve yourself. It means that person has no longer permitted you entrance into their space.
Exactly. And I'm like, I think you have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, there are going to be some people who like you misgender and they're not going to want to share space with you anymore. I think that's just a part of it.
It's valid.
And like also cancel culture is just like some made up shit, right? culture being the word that I just especially have an issue with in that kind of sentiment. Because it's like, okay, people that I can count on my hands that have gotten canceled are actually quite great. You know, Dave Chappelle is doing great. Who is it? Louis C.K. Amazing. You know, I'm like,
well, all these millionaires exactly that are canceled are fine.
Exactly. I'm like, okay, who has actually gotten canceled and why? Okay, you can say Harvey Weinstein got canceled, but Jesus, how many people did he hurt? And how many of those people were like privileged people who could do something about it?
Right.
Right. So I'm like, eh, I don't want to hear that. And I don't want it to be an excuse. So that's
like, we're talking about this, like the worst collection of horrible crimes.
Right.
Like you could, not worse, but very, very bad collection of a lot of horrible crimes that we shouldn't even, that shouldn't be a part of the conversation.
Right. Like nobody is like, oh, you misgendered me, you should lose your job. Like nobody's doing that really is how I feel. Right. So I think it's an excuse to just like not grow. Mm. There's a genuine fear with growth because it upends a lot of things that you have always believed.
Right. You have to rethink your kind of conception of the world.
Exactly. It's like, okay, you're asking me to, when you ask me to like bring transness into the room, like think more about gender, you're asking me to think about like myself also and how I relate to gender. And that's really scary to people. Mm-hmm. So then it's like this kind of lashing out that happens versus you actually sitting with your discomfort, right? Like, I think we're very scared to be uncomfortable right now, maybe is what it is. Because a lot of people also who are passing anti-trans legislation have actually never met a trans person.
Right.
I think there was a study done. I can't remember.
60% of, it's a Pew poll, 60% of Americans say they've never met a transgender person.
Yeah.
They probably have, of course, but they say they haven't.
Right. And then also like those numbers are so different with younger people versus like people 65 plus, like especially people 65 plus are like, I haven't met a trans person, but like overwhelmingly, those are the people who represent us on a national level.
Of course. Yeah.
Right. So I'm like, it's just fear. You actually know nothing about trans people. You know nothing about trans healthcare. You know nothing about trans youth healthcare, which people are saying like, oh, we just care about the kids. But it's like, okay, then you're going to take the next step and try to outlaw all trans people. We know how this works, right? Mm-hmm. And like, also, you are continuously seeing children as people who don't have agency, which is the issue, which is what we're asking you to rethink. And we're asking you to rethink like how actually violent this hazing process is for anyone who's not cis, right?
And well, and for cis people.
Yeah.
I know so many cis people who have so little access to their own identities and their own bodies. And that's kind of, again, going back to my friend Chase and what he said about our bodies, is we are, even the people who created the Constitution and who created the country based on protecting slavery, even they are departed from their own autonomy. And I would argue that they're probably even more so than the oppressed folks are more departed from their own humanity. And that's the problem. Like, I think enacting racism means you must lose a part of your humanity. Enacting transphobia means you must lose, or you're not accessing your full humanity, because if you did access your full humanity, you wouldn't try to rip it away from somebody else.
Exactly. And there's a reason why like cisgender men are having such a mental health crisis right now.
Exactly.
Because you put the world on your shoulders. Nobody asked you to do that, right? But you put the world on your shoulders and you really, you know, uphold these patriarchal values that you yourself can't even reach. And it depresses you. It makes you feel alone. It makes you feel like bad that like other people in your life, right, and yourself are like telling you that you're being a bad patriarch. I'm like, most people are going to be bad patriarchs because it doesn't make sense to be like, I have to be the breadwinner, I have to be X, Y, and Z, and I have to do all of this emotionless.
Without any emotions.
Right. Yeah. Like emotionless. It's like, of course you lash out when you feel anger, because everything you feel is like anger, sadness, you know, all of these other emotions that one is supposed to feel, you filter it all through anger.
Right.
So it's like, also, this ain't working for y'all. It ain't working for us, and it's also not working for you, but you feel so beholden to these systems, and you really need to think through why.
Right. Right. I love that. I think that's such a good invitation to anybody, right? Really, like I said, I really appreciate all the things you've shared, KB. As we wrap up, I'm curious, would love to have you read one of your poems. I don't know if you have anything that's specific towards sort of inviting allies in, if you want to talk about fear and grief. I know you could read Good Grief if you'd like, because that's the one I labeled earlier, but it's really up to you what you feel sort of most drawn to in the kind of context of our conversation.
Yeah, I want to invite people to buy my book.
Please do.
Yeah,
everybody should.
I have a poetry book coming out in a couple of months. It's called Freedom House. And Freedom House is a lot about how we get free as individuals, as communities, and also as systems. Yeah, it kind of chronicles my personal experience with transitioning, right? And how that's been a kind of freeing process. Also, you know, talks a lot through that process about like masculinity and, you know, romantic relationships, things like that. It chronicles also just like the political landscape of Texas and what it's been like to grow up in Texas as a queer and trans person. I don't know. I think it's a good read for anyone wanting to learn more about these things, wanting to feel validated.
Yeah.
About, you know, the experiences that they've had.
I think it's, I mean, you sent me a preliminary copy and I got to read, I'll admit I have not finished it, but I read a bunch of it and I really enjoyed it. And I think it's the what I'll say for listeners who hopefully will be readers of your book. I think it's very accessible and I really appreciate that. And what I mean by that is sometimes I find that poetry is a little bit difficult to read, for the average consumer, if that makes sense. Right. I hope that isn't offensive. I more just it's mean not, like sometimes like you read it and it's just cloaked in so many words and like the lines are confusing and sometimes it just takes a little bit too much brain power to read.
Right.
Yours is very eloquent, very well written, of course. And I think like the meaning comes on so clearly and I really appreciate that. And there's many moments where, I don't know, the lines made me think quite a bit. You had a line that said, I have a living, I have a room at the end of one of your poems. And I really liked that because I immediately thought of a living room, of course, but then I thought of what does it mean to have a living room? What does it mean to have a room? Anyway, so I was really grateful that you invited me to read that early.
Of course. Yeah, you bring up a good point. I really make it a point to like try to be a poet that invites someone to the page. I mean, of course, I think one thing that categorizes poetry as a genre is that it like acts a lot of a reader or like acts the reader to have a different relationship with the page than that of a novel or nonfiction book, etc. But, you know, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Could actually read this poem. Good grief. I'll admit that I've never thought about frostbite, trauma of the blood, a thing to be avoided when heat goes out for an entire state. I don't know where to place this grief, this sweltering state freezing, politicians breezing over to a country that doesn't have tissue choked out by its winter yet. The sky can only do what it does. The American government can only do what systems driven by green paper, violence, and ache can do. The trees bloom over dead bodies missing. The sound of hands rubbing, engines purring, hopes that gaslights or chafing or the rapture won't come first may quiver in my blood forever. I am black, and maybe I am doomed. Memory flashes like a computer screen. I see the Zoom link expand. Colleagues process whatever failure number of 1,000 this was this year, and I can only remember white. 6 inches deep, sunken into my boots all over. The timeline of friends stranded, impending doom of electricity shutting off. Water pressure slipping into nothing every hour, pipes bursting on top of all that white. I haven't recovered from seeing things that too closely resemble holes in a graveyard. I haven't forgotten the project is due in 2 weeks. My therapist says, take it easy, as if capitalism is listening, as if the body will ever forget what it's given. I am black, which is history personified. I used to listen to Pilot Jones fondly. With all this frostbite on my fingers, I'm not sure if I can type. I cannot finish another sentence on unity. What is unified about ERCOT letting us freeze, knowing how to fix the problem and not doing it? How does that form a kumbaya circle? If I made art about every pain I felt unjustly, I would be swimming in accolades for great American books. I would take back every word I've written if it ended this. America is the worst group project. I'm writing a great American poem about suffering. How much is going without food that isn't canned for a week worth? The absence of snow feels like betrayal. My memory mixes with American delusion. I can't believe half the things that I've been through. Ice cold, baby, I told you I'm ice cold. Who said it first? Frank Ocean or Christopher Columbus? I've never been taught how to adequately mourn the night spent bitching about a brisk wind. The night we almost got stranded trying to get to Jay before the cold swallowed them whole. I want to give everything I've been handed a good cry. Red skin and chapped lips deserve it. Good grief. What has Texas done to me? An article features a person walking past tents near I-35. I can't cry about the body, but I feel it. A highway splits a nation from its promise to be one. Everything feels blurry and the palm trees have died. Everything transported here withers away eventually. 6 months later and I haven't been able to shovel out of my sadness. A news report says it's safe to go back to work. And I listen, because what else can you do in 6 inches of white? Snow melted and I still feel frostbitten. There are no heroes in a freeze frame changing nothing. I pose, begrudgingly, say cheese, and then write this. Not a survivor, just still breathing. I remember grief, love's grand finale. What else do we have if not the memory of life? I cannot tell you how many lives I've lost to mourning, but I can tell you that the sky does what it does. Let's go for a walk and touch the trees that survive like us. Let's write a future more joyful and less inevitable in segments of leaves. Anything we dream will be better than this.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
It's different getting to hear you read it than it is to read it, so I really appreciate it.
Yay, I'm glad. Good that the book will also have an audiobook.
So. Yeah, excellent. I think it's always good because author, you can only put so much obvious stress when you write it, you know right. What I mean? So it's really lovely to hear how you meant the stress to be.
Go ahead. I just have like one more poem that may be useful.
Could you do like a, I don't know, 2-3 line intro of like what the poem is and why you wrote it maybe?
Yeah, this poem is called Fleeting Thoughts on a Dead Name That's Not Quite Dead. Mm. I kind of wrote it as I was thinking about the whole like name changing process. I used to go by a different name before the name that I go by now. And the whole like, we think about transition and immediately think medical, but there's also a kind of social transition.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
So literally just introducing people that have always known you as one name to a new name, it may have some like, you know, tension.
Right.
But then, you know, you introduce to people who don't have that like context of who you were mm-hmm. before you went by this name. And that feels different. And it also mm-hmm. feels different to interface with people who named you and be like, I reject that name now, and like deal with their feelings about it. So I don't know. The poem, I think, is just dealing with those complexities.
Yeah. Yeah. One more time, the title, if you would.
Bleeding thoughts on a dead name that's not quite dead. Indignant, I demand the panelists say my name. I'm begging my psyche to let me tell homies my new name. I put up with a name because it feels too much like home. New friends dap me up. Crowds of people call my name. The cashier can't hear me when I yell. It isn't hard to correctly spell my name. Two letters of secrecy, one for knowledge, one for fame. Baseline, it is my only name. I can't say it any clearer. In the mirror, I do not see a name. I see a face with many visions of hearing my name different. I hope my lineage knows I'm respectful of the name they've given. On legal papers, I'm ignorant to what I see on the page. Say my name. Say my name, but only if you let it change for me. I'm dead, as in I don't live for you anymore. I birthed myself to my own name.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Kind of goes back to that concept of like, who is blackness for, who is queerness for, right? You knowing what blackness was for you, but not for others. And then who do you live for? You or others. So yeah.
Right.
KB, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate how much of yourself you gave here as well. And both gave, but also invited us in. I think that's the most beautiful, thing we can do in terms of this space, but I know it's tiring and heavy, and I know you do it often. So, I just really appreciate you and all that you are.
Yeah, of course. And I appreciate you for having me and really engaging with the work. I mean, one of my dreams really is like trans people come across this book and like find something in it. Yeah. So I'm glad something resonated with you.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love reading writing by trans people, especially trans people of color, because I think we know there's a dearth of that generally speaking, right. But then, especially trans people of color. So yeah, I'm just feeling really grateful, sort of filled my cup a lot today. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yay. I'm glad it's not depleting. It's filling.
It is filling. Yeah. Awesome. Ooh. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
I mean, if you want to see my shenanigans online, I'm at Earth2KB, EARTHTOKB. I spell because people are like, oh, you have an accent. So it sounds like you're saying Earth with an F at the end. So EARTHTOKB, that's me on pretty much every social media thing. Buy Freedom House anywhere you get books. Recommended at your local library and bookstore. Just find me on the internets mostly.
Excellent. Thank you so much, KB.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to KB for taking the time. I'd actually never met KB before they walked into the Airbnb to chat with me that day, and whoo, they gave me some truly amazing things to think about. I am so grateful. Let's get to the episode's question. How can we liberate ourselves from gender as hazing? As KB mentioned, one of the first things is to reflect on the choices we have, the choices that we were given, and the choices that were actually made before we even came into this world. Remember, KB said, other people made choices for them all the time. And this creates a bit of a forced resilience. It's one of the reasons that a lot of people from many different marginalized backgrounds don't love the term bravery or being called courageous, because like KB said, and this is their direct quote, it tries to make normal things that are not normal. And I so agree with this. The second thing to do is to ask ourselves and reflect on who has access to gender as we are expected to perform it. Who has access to womanhood? Who has access to manhood? And the answer, as we talked about with KB, is really white women and white men. KB said anti-blackness is anti-transness, and if we look at the history of colonization and much of the formation of the gender binary as we know it today, this is so true. White supremacy is integrated into transphobia. Transphobia is integrated into white supremacy. So lastly, as we're thinking about trying to exit this concept of gender as hazing, I think we also need to consider our allyship and really our delving into our own genders, our own selves, as imperfect. We said it repeatedly in this conversation. The goal isn't to cancel someone because they didn't do it perfectly, but rather for us all to strive to be better. I think as we do this, I want to invite you to reconsider the words we use to attack others, to demean others, or even to demean ourselves, and consider how they demonize gender or the way that one person performs gender or inhabits their own gender. In one way or another, most of us, if not all of us, I would bet, perpetuate a world wherein gender is a way to haze people, to make people small, to put people in boxes. And I want to always imagine a world where our identities are just that, just ours. My own gender, my own race, my own body. So take some of these considerations forward. Ask yourself how you are performing your gender, if you're trans, and especially if you're not. Has gender hazed you too? Chances are it has. So investigate and divest from that system. And while you're at it, don't forget to check out KB's content online at Earth2KB and purchase their book, Freedom House, anywhere you buy books, but preferably from your local independent bookstore. Until next week.